You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, Ben Mathis here with a couple important announcements. You know that we have great advertisers that support the show and keep it free for you to listen. And one of the reasons why advertisers love Kick-Ass News is that they know the show has amazing listeners. Right now, we have a survey that I'd like you to take to help us learn more about our audience. Just go to podsurvey.com/kick. The survey will only take 5 minutes. We're going to ask you some questions about yourself and what you like to buy, but it's completely anonymous, and your answers will help us find advertisers that are well matched to you, your interests, and the show. And as a way of saying thank you, when you're finished, you can enter a monthly drawing to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Even if you've taken our podcast listener survey before, I'd like to ask you to take this one and help support the show. It'll be a big help to me, and don't forget that you have a chance to win that $100 Amazon gift card. Once again, that's podsurvey.com/kick. That's K-I-C-K. Thanks for helping us find the best advertisers so that we can keep the show free. Also, the holidays are upon us, and if you're like me, you'll skip the madness of the stores and do most of your shopping on Amazon this year. And if you're going to be doing that anyway, then help support the show by going to the sponsor page on our website at kickassnews.com and copying and pasting the Amazon link there into your web browser before you start ordering. Then Amazon will toss us a little something for every purchase you make this holiday season. You have to shop for gifts anyways. They've got just about everything you can imagine on Amazon delivered right to your door. It won't cost you anything extra, and you can help support the show. So it's kind of like giving two gifts for the price of one this year. And that, my friends, is what you call a Christmas miracle. So again, go to the sponsor page at kickassnews.com and copy our Amazon link into your web browser before you start shopping. And if you feel extra generous this Christmas, then make a donation to keep us going over here at gofundme.com/kickassnews. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis and welcome to Kick-Ass News. My guest today is former CIA analyst and targeter Neda Bakos. She's a highly regarded national security expert with 20 years of in-depth experience in global intelligence. In 1999, 30-year-old Neda Bakos moved from her lifelong home in Montana to Washington, D.C. to join the CIA. Entrenched in the predominantly male world of the CIA, Bakos belonged to a small yet dedicated sisterhood of female analysts leading U.S. Special Operations Forces to the world's most wanted terrorist. Quickly realizing her affinity for intelligence work, she was determined to rise through the ranks of the agency, first as an analyst and then as a targeting officer, eventually finding herself on the front line of America's war against Islamic extremists. In her role as a CIA analyst, she was a key member of the team charged with analyzing the relationship between Iraq, Al-Qaeda, and the 9/11 attacks. Subsequently, during the Iraq War, Ms. Bakos served as the chief targeting officer charged with finding the godfather of ISIS and mastermind of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Her work eventually led to Zarqawi's death in a targeted airstrike conducted by U.S. military forces in 2006. Neda Bakos can also be credited with directly helping to end the 10-year manhunt for Osama bin Laden by helping to identify the man who led U.S. intelligence agents to bin Laden's hideout in Abbottabad, Pakistan. She was featured in the PBS Frontline special, The Secret History of ISIS, and the Emmy Award-winning HBO documentary, Manhunt, The Search for Bin Laden. She's appeared as a guest commentator on CNN, ABC, Fox, MSNBC, BBC, and as a resource for journalists at The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and other media outlets. After leaving the CIA, Ms. Bakos worked in a key role with the Starbucks Corporation and as a consultant to corporate executives, senior-level government officials, and frontline technical teams, helping them understand the business and security-related context to deploying new processes and technology. Ms. Bakos is a senior fellow on national security at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and she's currently writing a book that comes out next year called The Targeter: My Life in the CIA on the Hunt for the Godfather of ISIS. Oh, and there are more than a few people who speculate that the character of Maya, the CIA officer in the Oscar-winning film Zero Dark Thirty, was directly based on Ms. Bakos, a suggestion that she dismisses with varying degrees of annoyance. Today, Neda Bakos will talk about how she rose up through the predominantly male world of the CIA to become one of the agency's top analysts and the chief targeter of the most wanted man in the world. She'll talk about the often tedious work of a CIA analyst and the frustration that comes with following a lead for as long as a year or more, only to have that lead not pan out or suddenly go dark. She'll talk about some fundamental problems with the top-down approach to intelligence and how that led to mistakes in the war in Iraq. She reveals how CIA trackers finally found Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, what she saw of the infighting between bin Laden's al-Qaeda and Zarqawi's al-Qaeda in Iraq, and how those communications eventually led to the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden himself. And of course, I'll ask Ms. Bakos for the millionth time if she is in fact Maya from Zero Dark Thirty. Coming up with Neda Bakos in just a moment. Today I'm joined by Neda Bakos. She's a former analyst and tracker for the CIA, credited in large part with having tracked down the terrorists Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and Osama bin Laden himself. Neda, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
First of all, I always ask this when I talk to anyone who used to work for the agency. Do you say the CIA or do you say just CIA?
CIA.
CIA. Okay, okay.
Doesn't matter.
You were an analyst at CIA, and then you later became a targeter.
Correct.
What's the difference between an analyst and a targeter?
An analyst does traditional analysis that you write reports, and it's delivered to the policymaker. And a targeting officer actually does similar work, but it's applied tactically. So you're using special operations or a drone or something similar to track your target.
In that role, do you have more interaction with the agents in the field?
Yes, or you're in the field yourself.
Well, how did you end up at CIA? Was intelligence analysis something that you had an inkling you might want to go into at an early age?
You know, my whole focus was living overseas. I wanted to do some kind of international work. I never really thought, oh, I want to be a spy. My focus was really just about trying to find a job in the early 90s, initially trying to work overseas. And when I eventually landed at the agency in the late 90s, I was just excited to
have one. Were you recruited?
I actually applied online.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Well, when you think of the intelligence world, you think James Bond, Jason Bourne, Tom Clancy. It has this very macho image. When you joined the agency, which was, I guess, now some 20 plus years ago, was that kind of a good old boys club still?
You know, depending on which department you went into, where the analysts are. It's very equal. It's men and women, and it's all about your brain. It's what you put on paper and what you're able to brief to the policymaker. So, but on the operations side, it had been traditionally men as case officers. It's evolving still, and it's in a much better place now than it was when I joined.
Yeah, and particularly within the analyst division there, you've had several women like yourself who've delivered some really big scores in the war on terror. Since Zero Dark Thirty, I think that the popular culture now even largely associates CIA analysis with women. I'm wondering if you think, is there a particular skill set or temperament that women bring to that specific job?
No, actually, I think traditionally it was women in the targeting role really early on before me. They were drawn to that role out of the analysis role because they saw a problem that they could affect and do something about on the operations side. They didn't want to become case officers.
Right.
So it wasn't a highly rewarding and visible job. And I think women are more inclined to take those kinds of roles.
yeah.
But no, men and women both have skill sets that can be applied and do. And there's men that have done just as well and better than some of the women you've heard about.
Still, I have to think that women probably have a lot more patience for a job like that than a lot of men.
That part is true when you look at the demographic, especially of the guys who are attracted to operations.
Yeah.
Yeah, their focus is getting out into the field, recruiting agents to spy on behalf of the United States and their constant movement. So they weren't really drawn to that job.
Yeah, because I can picture men in the analysis division chasing a lead for 6 months. And then it goes dark and they're punching a hole in the wall
or something. Not sure they'd last 6 months. But, if you the guys who are analysts, totally different story. They had the mindset. So it's really just about the skill set of the
Interesting.
Person.
Interesting. Well, I want to start with 9/11 because that's really where your career took off in the post 9/11 era. First of all, when the planes hit on 9/11, were you at Langley and what was that day like for you?
Yeah, I was at the CIA. Like everybody, it was very surreal. Al-Qaeda was well known to the entire building, so everybody was very clear. It was obvious right up front that it was Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. When that happened, was there a part of you that thought, wow, someone around here really screwed this up?
No, my first inclination wasn't who to blame. It was about what's happening next. What do we need to do? Where do we go from here?
Yeah. Well, after 9/11, the Bush administration was very eager to tie Al-Qaeda and 9/11 to Iraq and Saddam Hussein. And you were on the team that was charged with analyzing the quote-unquote relationship between Iraq, Al-Qaeda, and September 11th. Was there ever really any evidence of a connection?
There was no evidence of a connection, and we did report our findings to the administration and to Congress prior to the invasion, that there had never been a connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11.
Was there ever pressure on you guys to find something that wasn't there?
Pressure in the sense of, yes, we were coming at it from a completely different end, right? Mm-hmm. In intelligence, you follow the information, and then you develop your analysis based on that. In this case, we were being asked a definitive question and then had to backtrack and look for intelligence to support it or not support it.
Yeah.
And so there was pressure because this was such an awkward situation.
I'm curious then, were you also involved in trying to find evidence of WMD, or was that a separate thing?
Okay. That was a separate office.
Well, when we have intelligence failures, I wonder if that's part of the problem, this habit of kind of rigidly adhering to a theory, such as Saddam must somehow have a connection to 9/11, or Osama's got to be hiding out in a cave in this no man's land between Afghanistan and Pakistan. When we miss something, is that oftentimes part of the problem, that we just made up our minds and we don't look at the evidence that's right in front of our eyes?
Yes, but there is also within the culture of the CIA and within the training for CIA analysts, it's built in that the objectivity when you're looking at information is part and parcel of your job. Mm-hmm. And you go through several layers of reviews. You go through several layers of scrutiny by your peers. I mean, you're really raked over the coals when you're trying to, you know, push out a piece to, say, the president or Congress.
Yeah.
So typically it doesn't end up, in a sense, as an abject failure, unless there is some kind of, you know, mindset and cultural shift that's really at top levels, including administration.
Interesting.
That's open to hearing that type of information. So I would also say, having not worked on the WMT team, but having read the National Intelligence Estimate based on that, mm-hmm. that wasn't just an intelligence failure. It was also a failure by policymakers and administration not to really go through the NIE and understand the bottom line of how far out even that threat was predicted. I mean, if you sit down and read the NIE, the findings that the war was based on, there was no immediate threat. And they said that there was no immediate threat.
That's interesting, because you say that there are layers. So there is some kind of, at least within the intelligence community, there's some kind of peer review, for lack of a better term. But where there are failures, they're usually top-down failures.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
It's usually cultural.
Yeah. Well, you were later sent to Iraq in 2003 and assigned to track down Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and his network, which eventually became al-Qaeda in Iraq and then later ISIS. But this was very early on, before the insurgent attacks really began. So what was it that you were trying to learn about him at that early stage?
We had known about Zarqawi since he had trained in Herat, Afghanistan in the early 90s next to al-Qaeda. We were aware of his presence prior to the invasion. There was an opportunity to dismantle his camp that he had set up in northern Iraq. But the United States government chose at the time not to do that. So after the invasion, we were still focused on trying to answer administration questions on whether or not Zarqawi had any connection with Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda Central and or 9/11, in addition to then realizing he is still in the country and starting to wreak havoc.
Was it difficult to get certain people above you, perhaps, to shift focus from WMD and all that track to actually realizing that, okay, you're focused on this, which may or may not be real, and here's this other guy, and here's where the threat is?
Absolutely. I mean, it in my perspective, I think there was an organizational failure. You know, if we did still need to answer some of those historical questions and do the forensic analysis that the administration was interested in, we should have had a red team set up to do that. And but at the time, they were asking my team to do both. And it was really difficult to keep up with what was currently happening, trying to predict what Zarqawi's organization was going to do next, in addition to answering those historical questions.
Yeah, and much has been made of the feuding between al-Qaeda and Zarqawi in those days. Did you see much of that rift in the intelligence that you were getting?
Absolutely, yeah. Reading their communications about you know, the strategies and their arguments about how, you know, where each of them wanted to go with the conflict.
What were the bones of contention that were going on between al-Qaeda and Zarqawi?
So fundamentally, they both have the same overarching goals. Mm-hmm. But Zarqawi, and in the way he wanted to go about doing that, included killing Muslims, killing Shia. And al-Qaeda said, that's a big mistake. You're going to end up alienating yourselves. You won't be able to find recruits within Iraq. It's going to be very difficult. But he was tapping into the Sunnis, who were already starting to feel marginalized. Mm-hmm. So Zarqawi knew what he was doing. And this has since taken on, ISIS has taken this whole game plan as well.
How did you eventually track him down?
Prior to the invasion, Zarqawi was really not on anybody's radar except for the intelligence community and mostly the CIA. He was looked at for his, you know, nascent, very amateur efforts of WMD efforts and developing chem bio weapons, which was not very successful. My team was charged with looking at, as we talked about, the relationships Zarqawi had with al-Qaeda. and didn't have at the time prior to the invasion and during the invasion. He didn't join until 2005. But an analytical team I was on, in addition to the targeting team that I ended up help building, our whole focus was looking for Zarqawi and his organization and disrupting the organization. It takes years for all of this to culminate.
I can imagine.
I had actually left my role and moved on to another role few months before he was killed. And it didn't diminish, you know, for me, how I felt about having that result at the time. I thought, you know, I was so relieved. There were people on my team that did the hard work and in the military and were able to do that final, pull that final trigger. But as we all know, taking out one person doesn't always affect the entire right. situation.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Nate Abakos when we come back in just a moment. Today, I've been talking with CIA analyst Nate Abakos, and being an intelligence analyst is a lot like trying to stay informed in this crazy 24-hour cable news world of ours, searching through all the noise and the nonsense to get to reliable, independent information that isn't skewed isn't easy these days. I know my listeners are like me in that you value staying up on the latest current events, and you don't have time to waste sifting through junk news. You want concise, reliable, unbiased information on your schedule. Well, Reuters TV is the revolutionary video news app for busy people who want to know what on earth is going on. And believe me, now more than ever, I find myself asking, what on earth is going on? So I want you to do yourself a favor and go to Reuters.tv/kickass. You know, Reuters is the world's largest news organization with 2,500 reporters around the globe. And Reuters TV is video news as it should be. No hot air, no talking heads, and no theatrics. That's just how I like my news. I'll tell you, more and more, I have a hard time watching cable news because whether it's Fox News or MSNBC or even CNN, there's always an agenda. But you and I, we know what they're doing. They're trying to influence our opinion. I don't like that. I don't need to be told what to think. Just give me straight up, unbiased reporting on the facts, and then I can make up my own mind. With Reuters, that's exactly what I get. Go to Reuters.tv/kickass and check out some of the cool features. You can customize the length of your personalized news broadcasts anywhere from 5 to 30 minutes, and they update throughout the day. You can schedule downloads of broadcasts to watch offline whenever you want. You get live feeds of major news events such as presidential debates and press conferences, available on your favorite device, iOS, Android, Roku, and Apple TV. It's personalized, always up to date, and ready when you are. It's basically the opposite of cable news. See for yourself. Go to Reuters.tv/kickass. That's Reuters, Reuters.tv/kickass. And now, back to the podcast. You were also featured in the HBO documentary Manhunt, The Hunt for Bin Laden, which was done by a previous guest of the show, Greg Barker. While you were covering Al-Qaeda in Iraq, you ended up delivering a key piece of the puzzle that led us to finding him.
You know, that was just one of the pieces of the puzzle. And right. like I said, this is a long game. There's never a Hollywood moment in tracking people. The piece that I was involved in, it just happened to be that Al-Qaeda was sending an emissary over to talk to Zarqawi, try to strong arm him into buying into their agenda instead of his own. And this, they were also delivering communications, and we just happened to pick up that emissary, who then gave up a confirmation of the nom de guerre of the courier. That was bin Laden's courier.
Were you surprised when it turned out that he was hiding in sort of quote-unquote in plain sight in Abbottabad, Pakistan?
I think most of us had given up a little bit on the mountainous region.
Oh, really?
But plain sight in Pakistan was pretty blatant.
Yeah.
You know, that was a little bit of a surprise.
Well, I'm curious to talk to you a little bit about the work of an analyst. How tedious is the work of a CIA analyst?
It's very tedious.
It's not sexy, I imagine.
It is not sexy. Your day-to-day is really trying to you're downloading all sorts of information, synthesizing it, trying to pick out the disparate parts that are factual among all the noise and other signals, and trying to put it together so that it can make sense. It is the biggest jigsaw puzzle that you'll ever work on.
Yeah, and do you have moments where you're chasing a lead for a long time and it just goes dark?
Absolutely.
That's gotta be frustrating.
You're looking at various sources of information. So, whether it's disruption in some kind of technical system or if there's a human source, there's quite often a lead that ends up going dark that seems or it just doesn't pan out. It seemed very promising on the surface, but it turns out that it wasn't a valid one.
I'm wondering how many analysts work at CIA total, because there have to be
a classified number.
Oh, it's a classified number. I'm assuming it's a fairly high number. And it makes me wonder, how do all these little pieces of intel from different agents get organized into something that one can actually make sense of, something that paints a picture?
Technology is helpful, but there's still a huge challenge. We all would love technology to synthesize information perfectly and distill it for us. And there is a broader technology that's available to do that now, but you still need the human element of validating and verifying the information itself.
Yeah, I have to think that it would be difficult when one hand doesn't know what the other's doing and, someone has one piece of intelligence and someone has something else and it doesn't make any sense unless you put two and two together.
That's very true. And that speaks to intelligence coordination across the intelligence community itself, which has improved to a certain extent. But even prior to 9/11, there were FBI individuals sitting in the Counterterrorism Center at the CIA looking at the same information that the CIA analysts were.
Well, when you were tracking al-Zarqawi, at that time, did you see it growing into what is now modern-day ISIS? Could you have possibly predicted that it would have gotten this big and accomplished so much?
Well, al-Qaeda in Iraq, if they were left to grow on their own devices, I could see them achieving, where ISIS is now. Because ISIS is, like I said, they did pick up the same playbook. There is an al-Qaeda strategist, his name was Saif al-Adel, who built in 2005 steps that al-Qaeda should take. And al-Qaeda in Iraq was following some of those steps, and ISIS has since picked up that playbook and accelerated it, declared the caliphate much earlier than jumped a couple steps over what al-Qaeda traditionally was looking at doing. So while this seems like a somewhat unprecedented threat, it's not unforeseen.
Al-Qaeda never, as far as I knew, had this ambition to actually control territory and essentially build a terrorist nation state the way that ISIS does.
Yes, they did.
They did?
Eventually wanted to build a caliphate and still
do. I mean,
they
all talk about a caliphate,
right?
But, ISIS seems to be the first one who actually seems to be doing
exactly, and
it.
That is the contention between the two organizations. Al-Qaeda was doing it in a methodical way, knew that they would have to achieve other goals first, where ISIS went ahead and jumped ahead and did this. And that was one of the biggest contentions between Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, and Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda, which is part of why the two groups don't see eye to eye at this point.
Have we largely defeated al-Qaeda in its original incarnation at this point?
Defeated, I think, is the wrong term. I think what we've done is disrupt the way that al-Qaeda functions. Mm-hmm. But instead of al-Qaeda going away, it has dispersed and reformed in different regional actors, in addition to still having a centralized strategy.
Mm-hmm. If you were still at the agency right now, what would you want to know about ISIS?
I think one of the biggest unknowns we have about ISIS is truly how many members do they have? I think that's a very difficult number to capture in a confident way. But what we do know is that they have a lot more than al-Qaeda has ever had and has more trained people than al-Qaeda has ever had.
I wonder how far they're getting with these homegrown terrorists or technically unaffiliated terrorists who are inspired by their very well-organized media operation, here or abroad.
Right. San Bernardino is a good example of that. But if you look at the Paris attacks and Brussels, that was all connected to EU citizens who actually trained in Syria.
Right.
And had direct contact with ISIS governance. So that to me was not a homegrown situation.
Right.
That was a coming home situation.
Well, it's also, I have to imagine, from an intelligence standpoint, it's a lot harder to even pick up on a homegrown terrorist, some kid just sitting on their computer.
Right. That is very hard. It's like trying to find a thief who's not communicating with anybody that's going to, hold up a gas station.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
Yeah. Following the capture of al-Zarqawi and the capture of bin Laden and Zero Dark 30.
Which I have to say, I was not part of Zero Dark 30 and nor am I Maya.
Well, I got to come up with another last question, I guess, now.
You can say the other stuff and take that one out.
Okay. So you are not Maya.
Mm-mm.
Are you a little bit
so
Maya?
No. I was a targeting officer. She was a targeting officer.
Yeah.
We worked together. That's it.
you worked with Maya.
Yeah. But
okay,
that story
so you know
is
who
not
Maya
accurate.
Is.
That story is not accurate. I'll just say that right now.
Zero Dark 30.
There's not
like
five people
accurate?
Who did everything at the agency.
Are you telling me that an inaccurate film won an Academy Award? Well,
so let's skip over that part.
Okay. Well, ironically, I've never seen Zero Dark 30, so I wouldn't know one way or another. Surprisingly, I haven't seen it. Well, after all of that, do you feel that perhaps analysts at the CIA are finally getting a little bit of respect?
Possibly. But there are people who still believe in the traditional structure of how the CIA functions. Mm-hmm. And the targeting officer is a brand new role. So we'll see how going forward, how that all pans out.
Interesting. So when you say it's a brand new role, targeting officers didn't exist in the Cold War?
No, they did not. This organically grew out of the handful of women who before me were looking at Al-Qaeda.
Well, what are you working on now? You're now in the private sector. What are you up to these days?
I am doing speaking engagements, and I'm also a co-founder of a new tech startup.
Okay. And is that a security angle, or what are you doing?
No, it's actually much broader than that. It's looking for truthiness in the huge quantities of data that are out there on the internet. So it's
truthiness.
Finding facts,
okay,
and then evaluating the truthiness of those facts from a quantitative and qualitative aspect.
Now, is that a technical CIA term, truthiness?
No, it is not, but I think it's perfect.
Interesting. So what kind of facts are you analyzing?
You name it.
Is this similar whether to you're Snopes, or what are we talking
well,
about?
Well, actually, no. It's whether you're looking at medical research, and there's information within that research product that you want to know, is this actually factual? Not only are we trying to speed up and make that user more efficient, we're actually trying to insert integrity into the process so that we give a better, even nuanced answer to whether or not that is factual. Or if you're looking at a news article and there's a quote from Donald Trump and you want to know if it's factual.
We already know on that one, I think. I don't even have to look that one up. Terrific. That sounds like a great idea. Good luck with that. And I hear you have a book in the works.
I do, yes. It is currently in review and will hopefully be out February 2017.
Terrific. Well, I hope when it comes out, you'll come back on the show and talk about it.
Would love to. Thank you.
Well, Neda Bakos, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks.
Thanks again to Neda Bakos for joining me on the podcast. Her book, The Targeter, My Life in the CIA on the Hunt for the Godfather of ISIS, comes out in June 2017, but you can pre-order it now on Amazon. Neda Bakos is heavily featured in the HBO documentary Manhunt, The Search for Bin Laden, directed by previous guest of the show, Greg Barker. If you found today's episode interesting, then I highly recommend watching that film. Follow Neda Bakos on Twitter at Neda Bakos, that's NadaBakos. You can visit her website at nadabakos.com. and read more of her work as a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute at fpri.org. Again, check out our new advertiser and show them your support for the podcast by visiting reuters.tv/kickass. That's Reuters, reuters.tv/kickass. And don't forget to take our listener survey so we can keep this show free and find other advertisers who are best matched to you, our listeners. Just take 5 minutes to go to podsurvey.com/kick and take the survey. And when you're done, be sure to register for that $100 Amazon gift card giveaway. And once again, before you start your Amazon shopping this Christmas, visit the sponsor page on our website at kickassnews.com and copy our Amazon link into your web browser first. Then Amazon will kick us a little coin for every order you make this season. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.